Monday, February 11, 2008, House Committee on Government Accountability and Information Technology to order. And this is going to be just an informational meeting on the contracting study that was done by Department of Administrative Services and Dugan Petty. So I'm going to open that informational hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the state's chief information officer, and I'm also the administrator of the Enterprise Information Strategy and Policy Division for the Department of Administrative Services. You should have in your packet two pieces of information. One of them is a PowerPoint presentation that I'll present from this morning. And then also attached is an executive summary of a study that the PowerPoint presentation will be about. In 2007, the session in 2007, Representative Riley came to me and had a couple of questions about information technology contracting. He wanted to understand what the scope of information technology contracting was across the state, how much of it's being done, and he wanted to know if there was some opportunity to reduce costs or save money if we had more state in-house employees do some of the work that was being contracted out. So we spent about 30 days kind of scanning the universe of contracting and information technology to figure out how we might get a handle on that. It resulted in a survey that we went out to a number of state agencies on, and we found that there are basically two different types of information technology contracting work, primarily the IT project and project work, which makes up the bulk of the information technology contracting, and that's for the most part deliverables-based contracts where an agency has a project or a system or an application to build or modify. They go out with a request for proposal. A contractor comes in with a cost and a proposal. They make an award. They have a series of deliverables that the contractor must execute against, and as those deliverables are satisfied, the contractor is paid for that work. And that's there's some variance of that, but that's by and large the bulk of information technology contracting in the state of Oregon. There's another kind of work that is a much smaller subset of that that we call staff augmentation work. That work is done through what's called a managed service provider contract. And this may be maintenance or project development or project management or quality assurance work, some kind of information technology work that is primarily services in nature. And the managed service provider contract has an hourly rate that is utilized in calculating what those costs are associated with it. So it's more of a pay-as-you-go or pay-by-the-hour as opposed to the deliverable-based contracting methodology. So those were the two subsets that we found. We also asked agencies what are the factors that contribute to them contracting out for work, and generally they fall into about four different categories. Short timelines. They've got to get the work done, and they either don't have the staff or they don't have the FTE available, allocated to get this work done. Lack of skills. It may be that the scope and the nature of the contracting work that has to be done in developing a new system may take skill sets that are beyond what the agency has available to them. You'll see as we get further in the study a very significant piece of contracting work done by the Department of Human Services for their Medicaid Management Information System. That's a huge piece of work, and they did not have the staffing available, and I think the skill sets necessary to do some of that work. So that was the basis upon which they did that. Lack of staffing. It's a third reason. They just don't have the FTEs available to do that kind of work in their budget, but the work needs to be done. They have the contractual services money, the contract work. And then the fourth category that's mentioned in here is quality assurance, and it's really indicative of a kind of work that is better to be done from a third-party contractor because you want independent third-party credentials to do that work for you as opposed to doing it in-house. So quality assurance work lends itself to contracting work. The IT contracting study focused on 12 major agencies. These agencies probably have about 80% of the contracting activity, and so rather than go to 70-some agencies with a survey work, because there was no system that captured all of this information, we decided to focus, with Representative Riley's concurrence, with those 12 agencies, have them go through the study and then populate the study based on those agencies. And we focused on IT outsourcing work that was done from July 1st of 2005 through June 30, 2006. So what you have here is really a snapshot in time, and that was the most recent fiscal period that we had information on before the point when Representative Riley asked us to take a look at this information. If you'll turn to page 3 of the slides, we... For the purposes of the study, the IT work was defined as projects to develop application systems or operational activities such as systems maintenance and support. The participating agencies identified 186 information technology professional services contracts that fit in the parameters of the survey. Those contracts were divided into two basic categories. We talked a little bit about them first, the deliverable-based project work. And there were 126 deliverable-based projects during that period of time for those 12 agencies, and they totaled $104.3 million. The staff augmentation work, there were 60 contracts for staff augmentation, and they totaled $2.8 million. If you turn to page 4, you get a pretty good sense of the general results of the surveys. The 12 agencies are listed. Total number of contracts on the left-hand column, 186 in total. The total value of those contracts, $107 million. Of those, 60 were staff augmentation that had a total value of $2.8 million. And then 126 of those with a total value of $104 million were the deliverable-based contracts. And again, as you scan through the total value of these contracts, you'll see in the DHS column, a whopping $95 million. If my memory serves me correctly, $82 million of that was for the Medicaid Management Information System. And we should say that the way the survey results are is that some of these contracts might be delivered over time, may take 5 years to deliver, but the estimated full value of the cost of the contract is accounted for in this year of total contract value. So if you go back at the end and look at how much was actually spent on these contracts during this period of time, it may be and probably will be significantly less than this because, in theory, some portion of the MMIS contract for the Department of Human Services would be paid for during that time. You turn to page 5, we'll talk a little bit more about the details of the study. From that initial scan of the 12 agencies, we found that there were 5 participating agencies: the Department of Administrative Services, Department of Human Services, Oregon Department of Employment, Oregon Department of Forestry, and Oregon Department of Transportation, that had staff augmentation contracts that seemed to fit into the methodology that we attempted to use for the study. Of those 5 agencies, there were 161 of the total contracts, so they represented 86.6% of the total value of all the contracts. And there were 50 staff augmentation contracts for those. I've already talked a little bit about staff augmentation and what that means. This is probably a good point to explain why we thought that was the best way to go about doing this analysis. If we didn't really have any way to go back and look at the deliverable-based contracts and do a comparison of what the contractor's costs were for that work if it had been done by state employees. And the reason we didn't have any kind of a basis is because we had no way of knowing for sure what the hours were that went into those contracts, and we didn't have any good way of knowing what the wages paid for the skill sets or the work that was performed by those contractors. That information, if it were to be obtained, would have involved going back and surveying the contractors themselves, and that probably would have been difficult, caused them a lot of time and effort to go back through their records. So we set that aside, and we said, is there an easier way to get at this? And that's where the staff augmentation work comes out. What we did with the staff augmentation work is we had the ability, because we knew what the hourly billable rates were, to go in and calculate based on what was paid to those contractors. We divided those rates into the amount paid to determine what the hours were worked in each of those contracts. So we were able to do an analysis to look at the hours by the contracts. And then we were able to take those hours, knowing that they went into Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3 skill sets off of the managed service provider contract rates, and we were able to allocate those tiered skill sets for the managed service contract provider's hours to either an IS6, an IS7, or an IS8. And then we simply took the hours and we said, all right, if we had an IS6 doing that work, how much would that cost times those hours? Now, to do that, we had to go in and make sure that we had fully loaded rates for the employees. It factored in, because we had billable hours, we had to also factor in the time off, the holidays, the breaks, which also calculated into it. Some other assumptions you'll see in this study where we talked about, since the staff augmentation work comes in largely and does work within our premises, then we are assuming that if we had a state employee do it, that the office space would be about the same, that the infrastructure piece would be about the same. There's no equipment supplied in either case, so we assume that's about the same. And we also said that in terms of supervising the employee or managing the contractor, that the time involved with doing those should be about the same. So we held those even, and we did that calculation. But that gave us a basis upon which to say, all right, state employees being paid at this rate, these are the fully burdened rates compared to what we paid under contract, times those hours would give us an ability to compare the two. We didn't have any basis upon which we could do that with the deliverable-based contracts. So the high-level cost analysis of the 50 staff augmentation contracts, we compared the maximum not-to-exceed hourly rates from the managed IT service provider contract to the applicable fully loaded information specialist rates at 5, 6, and 7, as I've said, and talked about the rate time. If you turn to page 6, we allocated those fully loaded rates across the 9 pay steps on a billable hourly basis, and it's better to probably talk about this as we go to the next slide on page 7. The difficulty, if you'll turn with me to page 7, this spreadsheet shows the classification of the ISS positions in the left-hand column running from ISS1, and as you can see, there are only 11 in all of the state government, very few at that low level, all the way down to the ISS8. There are 168 ISS8s throughout all of state government. So this column gives us the different classifications of the ISS positions, and then tracking the columns from the left to the right, it is the class title, and it is really the step. So in the top left-hand corner, we have very few low-step IS1s. And if we go down to the bottom, we have actually very few low-step ISS8s. You go all the way to step 9, you can see that there are more in the advanced steps. And what's interesting here, I think, is if you come down to the percentage at the bottom, this gives us the distribution of steps by position, and you can see that 43% of the ISS range is at the step 9. Well, and then if we go over to step 5, we've got 5.14% at step 5. And so between step 5 and step 9, 80% of all of our ISS classifications are step 5 to step 9. So it's at a step level, we're really skewed towards the high end of the scale. So if we're going to compare an ISS6 to a Tier 1 managed service provider contract rate, the question then becomes, do we compare it at step 2, step 3, step 9? Where do we compare it? And that really, as you'll see, makes a difference in how this cost comes out. And in the end, we couldn't pick one and said this is the right one. We really had to pick a range, and we said that the range is somewhere probably between a step 6 and a step 9. We calculated the costs, the potential cost savings at those steps that would give us some idea of what that range would be.
Dugan, Representative Edwards has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dugan, could you give us some anecdotal information about, I mean, what's the difference between step 9 and a step 5? I mean, this is all just, to me, as I'm hearing the information, it's just all class steps on on a paper. But I mean, what does that mean in practical knowledge and skills and whatnot in the workplace?
Anecdotally, I guess the best way to think about the steps is that they're roughly equivalent. If you started at a step 1 in a classification, at step 9 you probably would have been there about 9 years, because assuming your performance is good, you would advance up. So in terms of skill sets, the skills necessary to enter at an ISS 8 should be pretty much the same at the lower step as it is the upper step, but you have years of experience, and so you may become better skilled at certain applications that the agency has. You've probably got broader experience in doing those applications. In the ISS field, it's not uncommon to see people move between agencies, so you might have a broader a background of different agency experience.
Okay, so it would be then the steps are really the steps are weighting experience.
Exactly.
And then you're going to have more of a difference in hard skills. I mean, assuming that there's some difference that comes with experience, but actually training and what they're entering for, along with the ISS 1 through 8, there's going to be, is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement.
Okay.
If I could, Dugan, I've had a lot of years of experience of hiring IT people and placing them actually in state agencies and other places, and it turns out that very few people are actually hired at the lower steps, because first of all, the pay ranges in the state don't allow us really to hire good people, the ones we want, at the lower steps. So what typically happens is you'll have an opening in some range. You'll have an opening for certain skills, and those skills demand a ISS 7. And so you look for people with those skills, and you have a variety of people apply, usually 20 times more than the number of positions you have at least. And you pick the best one, and you offer them, based on their experience, some step level inside that. So typically someone will maybe start at step 5. That's
right.
Very often people start at the mid range as opposed to base range, so that they've already had those years of experience somewhere else, and then they'll move up with their years of experience after they get here. Is that?
That's exactly right. And it's in this particular area, we've thought for a while that in the information services field that we were having difficulty attracting positions at our pay classification, and we've had some outside experts come in and present to us on that, from Gartner, for example. We did a kind of a seminar on where we're at and what kinds of things we ought to be doing to improve our ability to recruit and retain these important positions. And what we found is that it's a problem everywhere. It is a problem in government. It's also a problem in the private sector. And so, consequently, as we try to compete with these positions, I would venture to say that probably at these high skill sets, probably very few people are hired below an IS, the step 4, as Representative Riley has said.
Thank you. That's helpful.
So if you move on to page 8, there are some assumptions that we made in this study to do this comparison. One of them was that the in-house full-time employees with the requisite skill sets and experience to perform the work were available or could be hired. Because obviously this breaks down if they're not available or if you can't get them, and also that the quality of the work would be comparable. So we've assumed that from a qualitative standpoint that the work is the same and the skill sets are available. We've talked about being able to hire them at the appropriate classification, that they would be available and could be hired. The third bullet talks about using them 100%. This has really got kind of two factors. One, if we had a project, would we have, the assumption is that we have in-house FTE available to do 100% of the work. You have to make that assumption because when you hire a contractor, you have them available to do the work 100% of the time. And also, you have to assume that you would be able to move them to another project, that you wouldn't have them just setting when the project was done, because if they were just setting and not being utilized in fulfilling a project, then you'd have to count that time against the project. So it assumes that they come in for the hours, that they're available for the hours necessary, and when they're done, they move on to another project, and they'd be allocated against the other project. No additional direct supervision would be required for the ISS employees. This, again, assumes that there's really about the same level of supervision, which I think is a fair assumption here, because for the staff augmentation, somebody has got to make sure that the expectations are set for the work and follow up that the work has been done. Same thing with an employee.
If I may, on that particular point, it's my experience that you probably would even need less supervision for in-house because you know them. They've been around. You know what they can do, and they know what's expected of them much more than someone who comes in for a project and goes away.
Yes, I think that's probably true. There is some of that. They know where things are. They know the network. They know what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Current available workstations, telephones, computers, office supplies would be available for both the in-house work or for the contract staff augmentation work. Current salary schedules for ISS staff and current contract rates from state price agreement provide a reasonable basis of comparison. Now, this is a snapshot in time, and both the labor rates have gone up since then and the managed service provider rates have gone up since then. And we have done a brief scan on that, and we think that that's held about the same as this study, but we haven't done a lot of detailed work on that. And we know that the managed service provider rate is about to go up one more time.
Representative Thatcher, you had a question.
Thank you. You were talking earlier about using fully loaded rates, and you gave some examples of what was loaded into the above and beyond the, what they get in their paycheck. And I know I didn't see anything about workers' compensation or liability insurance or unemployment insurance or FICA or Medicare. Is that not something that would be included? Or?
Well, I would have to go back and look to see specifically if those were in. I know that the retirement and benefits were calculated into it. So my assumption is that the FICA would probably be in it as well, but I can go back and verify that and get back directly to both of you.
And I do remember, is it Sue in HR saying
yes,
that all those were included? I remember from our meeting that she indicated every FICA and all that was included in this rate.
It just wasn't clear in here. That's what I'm double checking.
We'll go back and double check and get back with you, Chair Riley and Representative Thatcher.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Page 9, both sets of rates excluded overhead costs related to on-site supplies, materials, workstations, computers. We really kind of hit that. The cost comparison and the study were conducted using the maximum service provider rates and the ISS rates. And we also wanted to, I guess this is more of a disclosure than an assumption, but there are a variety of unique projects with specific project variables that really have to be assessed on a project-by-project basis. So this is a pretty high-level view. There's a danger in thinking that this high-level assumption will hold in every case at every project level. There just wasn't a way to get into it at that level, at least that we had anywhere near enough time to do. On to page 10, it really goes over the results of the comparison. You see the five agencies in the left-hand column that were involved. The next column to the right shows the number of staff augmentation contracts were compared and showed the value of the staff augmentation, 50 contracts, $2.5 million. And then there are a series of adjustments, which is where we've taken those staff augmentation costs, taken the number of hours out of those staff augmentation contracts, and then recalculated them or adjusted them based on what it would take if we used our own ISS positions to do the work. And we've compared them at step 5, at step 7, and at step 9, and step 9 is the far right column, and you can see that it makes a big difference where they're hired. And so we have best case scenario in terms of savings by using state employees is if they were all at step 5, there'd be about a 15% savings, 14.6% over what we paid under the contract rate. On the other hand, if they were all calculated at step 7, the savings has been reduced to 7.8% of potential savings, and now we're down to a total of $196,000 out of $2.5 million. And then finally, if all of the staff augmentation work were done by state employees at step 9, then the savings is just $9,000, and it's just at 4%. So in all cases, we showed savings. In reality, I think if you allocated out where these would be, it's probably going to be somewhere between $9,000 and $365,000 savings, or between 4% and 15%. And you can see that in all cases, the agencies would show savings except for the Department of Transportation. And in that case, if these were calculated and all the ISS positions were at step 9, they would have actually incurred a cost over the contracting. And we believe that is that that they had some of their staff augmentation contracting actually at a better rate than what was in the managed service provider rate.
And that's basically because they have the highest volume of anybody, and so they can negotiate better rates. If we take out ODOT out of that, it jumps significantly.
Yeah. So in general, the range of savings that we found with these 50 contracts, we think would be somewhere between $365,000 and $9,000, or somewhere between 15 and 4%. If you move over to page 12, we'll go over some the conclusions. It was based on the assumptions and the scope of the study, and it was the 50 contracts of the staff augmentation. Increasing ISF staffing to match the project demand could enable agencies to perform more work in-house in lieu of staff augmentation contracts, and that does have the potential of achieving cost savings. The second bullet, increasing information system specialist staffing levels in current classification schemes can address some project demands, but it won't completely remove an agency's need to outsource work. If you remember, there are a number of factors that contribute to a decision to outsource, and those would still be the case. This study shows that there's some opportunity in staff augmentation, but staff augmentation operates fundamentally different than deliverable-based contracts. So it would be a mistake to conclude that this same methodology and these same savings would hold true under deliverable-based contracts. They might, in some cases, might not. So to extrapolate, for example, that there's a 15 to 4% savings available in all the deliverable-based contracts, this study isn't suggesting that. It's just suggesting it around staff augmentation. And finally, the volume of outsourced work will fluctuate over time as agency project demands go up and down. Next steps, we looked at this and we said, well, what can we do to capture some of this? There's obviously some opportunity here to do things more efficiently. I presented to this committee in the interim our Enterprise Information Resource Management Strategy document. We have modified that document to include some work in this area, and it will involve identifying and classifying skill sets in information system service positions, and then creating a database or a compendium of these positions. And the purpose of this is that if an agency has a need for a project and another agency has some staff skill sets that might be available to do that project that could be used more efficiently and accomplish this work, then we want the agencies, all the agencies in state government, to understand what's available out there and be able to bring that skill set in to do that particular work. So part of it is building a compendium or a clearinghouse of these skills, the inventory of these skills. And then the other part of it, the action piece of it, is taking the job rotation system that is already in place and putting that in a kind of an online version along with this clearinghouse, so that we make it very easy for an IT manager in one agency to spot an available skill set in another agency, do a job rotation, bring them on for that project, use them for a short period of time, get the work accomplished, and then send them back. We think that's just better utilizing our in-house available resources. So that's work that's in place. We expect to have that, be working on that in the third and fourth quarter of 2008 and have it completed in the fourth quarter of 2008.
And the HR director is very excited about this, I believe. She's very, very willing and wanting to do this, and says that it's something that they very much can and would like to do.
Well, when you think about it, we tend to have these projects within information technology, and having somebody that's got skills in Java programming is what may be key to the project. And so if it's in another agency, if you can bring them in, get the work done, that's just good use of your resources. But it's not really just information technology. I mean, there's opportunity here, if we can make this work here, to maybe expand that to other areas as well.
Representative.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Dugan, could you did you get a sense in talking with the various agencies, perhaps just even anecdotally, about rates of turnover that you see in your contractors versus within the agencies, and some comparison, private versus public sector?
This is just anecdotal, but
and that's really all we could provide.
Representative Riley. Representative Edwards, I would say that not only is recruitment challenging in the information technology field, but retention is very challenging as well. And while it happens both in the contracting and the in-house side, it has been problematic in-house. I mean, I've seen that in my own organization, where you have a very well-qualified project manager, somebody with good technical skills. If those are in high demand, they may very well have a lot of opportunities to go to work in any number of different situations. And sometimes the salaries can be very challenging for the state to keep up with. To some degree, that's somewhat mitigated, less so in the contracting field, because when you sign on with a contractor, you get a level of service, and you usually have the ability to approve somebody new coming in, but sometimes they turn over as well. I say in the staff augmentation area it might not be as acute, because a lot of times the staff augmentation contractors, the people that actually do that work, have a variety of different contracts, so they're kind of moving around from place to place, and so some of these could be short-term contracts, so you might not see that turnover as much. But if you do have a longer-term contract, or deliverables-based contract with a large firm, it's not unusual to see turnover there as well. It's a dynamic area.
In addition, we heard very clearly at the conference that you and I both attended that the people coming into the workforce now are much less likely, or much more likely, to want to work for a government where they see a public benefit, and then we have in the past. I know when I was new in this business of IT, and IT was new at the same time, we moved a lot. I mean, I could move across the street and get a huge raise, so we moved a lot. But that's really that's really slowed down significantly over the years, and now programmers, frankly, are a dime a dozen, and so they're not moving nearly as much as they used to. So you had another question.
Yeah, I guess my follow-up would be the flip side of turnover being from a management side, dismissing subpar performance. Is there a significant difference between our private contractors and our state agencies in the ability and frequency with which employees are dismissed, for just lack of doing a good job?
Chair Riley, Representative Edwards, I understand your question, but I have to tell you we just didn't look at that area at all, so I can't respond to that from the report.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not even sure where I'm going with this, but what isn't mentioned is, and whether there was even any value in it in this study, is the length of the contracts, the variation in length of contracts that you're doing, and how that would play into cost savings or any of this. I don't know.
Chair Riley, Representative Beyer, I think that's a good question. I think what you would find from the staff augmentation work is those contracts tended to be shorter term, temporary in nature. The longer term work, for example, that Medicaid Management Information System, and that will be built over 5-6 years, a very long term effort. But the staff augmentation work is temporary in nature. In fact, the managed service provider contract refers to that as just a temporary kind of activity, and it's not meant to be a long term engagement.
Typically, those contracts are 6-month contracts, renewable 1 or 2 times, and actually, typically, the person in filling that contract will do 2 or 3 6-month contracts, and then go away for 6 months and come back again after that. And the reason for that is the lawsuits up in Washington. If we hadn't had those lawsuits up in Washington, they wouldn't go away for that 6-month period, because almost always there are projects to be done. That's really true. You could these contractors, until that lawsuit at Microsoft came about, contractors were typically renewed every 6 months for years. And that lawsuit stopped that. So they stay on for about a year and a half, and then they have to go away, and then they come back again, possibly, if they don't find somewhere else that they can stay for a year and a half. But you had another question.
Yeah, I have two questions now. The first would be the nature of the contractors. When I think about in my own mind, when I think about contracting now for information technology services, I'm assuming that the state agency in question is putting out a request for bids or request for proposals to some sort of an IS or IT firm that has, 10 employees or 20 employees or 30 employees or maybe 200 employees. Is that really what we're talking about, or are we talking about individual contractors who are really one-person shops that are bidding on a job, and they're really a one-man or one-woman show, and there's an opening, but they're bidding on it as a contractor rather than actually becoming a state employee.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, in the managed service provider contract, which is where the staff augmentation work is filled, there is a request for proposal that goes out for a managed service provider. That contractor provides a fairly effective and convenient way for agencies to go online and select the skill sets they need, and that managed service provider is almost like a broker in one sense, because they'll have a number of subcontractors that they will then look at those qualifications that are necessary and submit those to the agency. The agency will then select from those and receive the services of that contractor through the managed service provider. It can utilize, not only is the managed service provider contract in place, but there are subcontractors that can have any number of sizes. So there's an opportunity there for a small contractor to interface as well as larger contractors. That managed service provider contract is intended to be temporary in nature, and it is services. So it's classified at a variety of different skill sets. It's not the kind of thing we'd use to buy equipment, or they wouldn't furnish equipment. It'd just be service. So that's how those are selected. The deliverable-based contracts are usually selected through an RFP process individually by the agency, and the complexity of that solicitation and award process is usually driven by the size and complexity of the contract. So there can be smaller contracts that are individually selected, and the deliverable base might have the contractor come in and do a feasibility study and leave, or they might develop a system and provide equipment and programming to put that system in place and some training and that sort of thing. So it's much broader.
In partial answer to your question about the managed service provider, the state will have a list of managed service providers that have enough skill sets to warrant looking at them. And so the individual or the very small shop will have to go through one of those managed service providers to get to the state. If I'm Chuck Riley Computer Consulting, a few years ago, I would not be able to get a contract with the state on my own. I wouldn't be big enough. I wouldn't have all the skill sets that they could select from. So I use an agent, and that's how I think of the managed skills providers, is they're an agent. So,
yeah. Is that that's fair.
So, follow up?
Sure.
So, I guess there's going to be a distinction between the managed service contract and the deliverable contract, but could you speak a little bit to each? Sounds like within the managed service contract arena, it'd be fair to say that there are a fair number of firms that are available to bid on each contract that's put out. What about in the deliverables type of contracts? Are you putting out requests for proposals and getting one proposal back on each? Or is it reasonably competitive?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, I believe it's reasonably competitive, but it depends a lot upon the nature of the project and how the project is specified and what's available. Some projects might be unique and have a lot of unique factors and complexity to it that there may only be a few contractors that do that kind of work. On the other hand, it could be very broad, and there could be a lot of competitors. So those contracts that we talked about as deliverable based, I don't believe that the State Procurement Office has a kind of like a, they don't have a price agreement or a term contract that covers all of those. It might be nice. The agencies might appreciate that because they're easier to access. But I think most all of that work is individually competed. Now, if it's under $150,000, the agency has some options of getting some smaller procurement processes or less formalized processes, but over $150,000, it must go to the State Procurement Office, and it has to be procured through an RFP process.
And even the most complex and specialized projects will find at least two or three companies who have some expertise and are willing to bid on an RFP.
Yeah.
Other questions? Dugan, thank you very much. I really appreciate your willingness to do this study and to share the results with us and to do some follow-up work. And I'll be anxious to see, you know, how the database, how the job sharing goes. And I'd also be interested in if, because of this, some agencies look at possibly a smaller contract work and maybe some more positions in the agency. I'd like to see what comes of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
members of the committee.
Committee members, that's all we have for today. Anything? Actually, before I close committee, one of the things that we're going to be looking at, I'd like Representative Edwards to give just a real brief rundown of an idea that he wants us to hold an informational hearing on. Just very brief.
Sure. Okay. Fellow committee members. I'm interested. I have a constituent with an interesting issue that I think would be worthy of this committee taking up, since we are the Government Accountability Committee. And my constituent, they've fallen in this regulatory no man's land. There are a number of county and state agencies who may or may not have caused this constituent harm.
And it is a business, I mean.
And it is a business in my district. And there are a number of state and or county agencies who could fix the business's problem, but everybody is pointing the finger at somebody else, and so sorting through some facts in the situation, and perhaps serving as a conduit to get some agencies together, and there are five or six agencies involved, all with different budgets that could be involved, I think could be a valuable, or it'd certainly be valuable to this business, who I really feel like has been, for lack of more articulate language, screwed by various agencies, again, who will all point at one another and whose responsibility it is to fix that problem.
So Dan's looking into the possibility of a informational hearing, which we hope will take an hour or less.
Yeah. And I appreciate the opportunity.
So with that, I'm going to close this session. Thank you all very much.